Welcome to 9-to-5 Mac Watch Time, a podcast usually about the Apple Watch and how it impacts people's lives. This week I want to focus on a different impact being made in people's lives across the nation and across the world since last week. My goal for this podcast has always been to be honest and raw and real and learn, and turns out the Apple Watch is one avenue that allows me to explore that side with guests. But this week I want to dedicate this episode to the memory of George Floyd, a name that I think everyone will recognize. He is the 46-year-old African-American male who was killed on Memorial Day after being handcuffed by Minneapolis police and pinned down on the street for almost 9 minutes with a knee on his neck. Floyd was stopped for allegedly passing a fake $20 bill, so it's just incredibly hard to imagine how this could happen, but here we are. The loss of George Floyd's life adds to the heartbreaking list of African Americans who have been killed at the hands of systemic racism in the last decade alone, from Trayvon Martin to Tamir Rice to Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And for that reason, in this moment, systemic racism is the only thing I want to talk about, understand, and be educated on. Joining me in this very special episode of 9-to-5 Mac Watch Time is iOS developer and the subject of the awesome documentary app, The Human Stories, Ish Shabazz. Tremendous thanks for joining me on this somber week, Ish.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So to kick things off, tell me a little bit about yourself. So you're an iOS developer. I believe you're based in California. Kind of what's your background?
Yeah. So my name is Ish. I've been an iOS developer for 10 years. I guess I started right after Steve Jobs introduced the iPad. I had my very first app idea, and I was trying to figure out, well, do I want to get this device or not, trying to talk myself into it. And I thought, you know what, why don't I just try to make that app and see how it goes. Of course, at that time, I didn't really know how to make apps, and the idea I had wasn't even the technology didn't exist yet for it, and it took me, I think, like another 8 years to get to the point that I could make that app. But basically, since then, I've been making iOS apps. And for a while there, for about 6 years, I spent quite a bit of time doing app-related stuff, about 18, sometimes 20 hours a day, just basically kind of learning and sharing and being involved in the iOS developer community and all that. In that time, I think I put, I don't know, maybe 25 apps out on the store. Many of those did not survive, but I learned a lot of good lessons in things about the app economy, the app ecosystem, and just kind of developing apps. So,
right. That is awesome. The last app that I recall is Capsicum, right? Which is
correct.
Named after the bell pepper, and it's the planning app for iOS.
Yeah, and that's actually the app idea I had way back when, 10 years ago. And it's quite an involved app. There's a lot going on. So you have a combination of like to-do lists and notes and calendaring and even weather. So there's a lot to it. But yeah, that will likely be my last large app project, but that's one I plan to kind of ride out into the sunset with.
Oh, that's awesome. And what you're in California. Have you always lived in California, or did you grow up there?
I was born in Louisiana. We can talk about that
okay,
a little bit later.
All right.
But I moved to California when I was like 10 months old. So most of my life I've been in California. I did. I spent a little time in Colorado. I moved out there for work, and I was out there for 2.5 years, but almost all of my life I've been in California.
Where in Louisiana?
Ruston, Louisiana.
Ruston. Okay. Not familiar with it. What part of the state is that in?
It's towards the southern side, I believe, but I'm really unfamiliar. Like I said, I left when I was 10 months old. I went back through on a road trip through,
My mom's, that was the next question.
My mom's home state of Louisiana and my father's home state of Mississippi. We're going to Mississippi, and I was there briefly, and in that brief time I was just like, nope, the South is not for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I haven't spent much time in that area at all.
Well, why is the South not for you?
At the time it was the pace of the South. was a real thing. As I got older and realized, became kind of like just more aware of the racism in the South. Now there's racism in California also. I've grown up with racism, being a black man in the U.S. That's just, this is a part of life. It's a constant. But some of the things I experienced, not particularly on that trip, but as I got older, I went to North Carolina once. Right? I went to North Carolina, and I went to a grocery store for something. I don't even recall what. And I went to the checkout line, and suddenly the entire store just went quiet. You know how normally, like, there's always this background chatter in a room where there's people. There's just always this whatever. Suddenly, you could hear a pin drop. And I was looking around to figure out, like, what is going on. I looked down to make sure that my zipper was okay and that was good. And I just couldn't figure out what was going on. And I looked to my left and noticed that there was a line that was long. So I didn't pick that line. And every single person in that line was black with a black cashier. And the line that I was in, every single person is white with a white cashier. And it just hit me. I was like, you gotta be kidding me.
Wow.
Really? That's what this is about? This is, I think it's around 2006, somewhere in there. And I was just like struck, like, whoa, that's different. Because we do have, in California, it's mostly people who are covertly racist or even unaware of their own racism. Mm. Like they have the, biases and they've kind of bought into certain feelings or perceptions. They don't even realize it.
It's like ignorance to not know.
Completely. Cause they have black friends. They're like, how could I possibly be racist? I have a black friend. Turns out racism isn't just like, I would lynch a person on sight, right? There's levels to it, right?
Yeah. It's not all negative intent. It's also that there's just ignorance and misinformed, ill-informed, lack of exposure, lack of context.
Correct. And the way that I try to help some folks understand it is not the same as sexism, but it has a lot of things in common with sexism.
Sure.
Right? So you can completely be, because our society in the U.S. is full of both of these things, right? You're kind of like steeped in it, you're surrounded in it. And because it's a constant, anything is there all the time. It makes it difficult to know when it exists until it's gone.
Yeah.
So, a lot of the times folks will be like, well, how could I be racist? I have a black friend. Okay. Well, how could you be sexist? Your mother is probably a woman. Yeah. It's totally possible, right? And I relate it to my own ignorance about sexism. So for a long time, I did things that were sexist I was completely unaware of. Certain language I would use, didn't realize.
Sure.
The word bossy, for example. That's inherently a sexist term. And I didn't realize it.
You don't use it on a male, right?
Because everyone that I thought, everyone uses this, right? How could I be? I love women. I would never do this. I don't call myself a feminist because I think that that's not a title that you thrust upon yourself. I think that basically it's a reflection. So if other people see me and they're like, wow, he's a feminist. I wear that with, like a badge of honor, right? But I can't say it for myself because that's me diagnosing my own blind spot. I feel the same way when people often talk about racism. Like, I'm not a racist. Really? Because racism is often an unconscious bias. How would you possibly know what unconscious bias you have? Because by definition, you know, it's not conscious. Now, there's for sure conscious racism, right? There's for sure, like, I hate people of a certain type. I hate these folks. There's that. But the reality is, I think really the folks who are unaware of their support of the system, their apathy towards it, or the ability to not have to care about it, to not really think about it and think it's like a thing of the past, that really gives cover for the folks who are overtly racist. Because for many, many times, right, even in cases of, like, police brutality, often, the things we're seeing on the news, at least on Twitter, I don't know about the news, on Twitter now with the videos, that seems very new. Because often the case is what happens. If you are black or a person of color, and there is a white person in the car with you, then nothing's going to happen, actually. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of the same way, again, with sexism. A lot of times people are like, oh, Mike is great. He's never done anything to me. He's never been around me. Like, well, yeah, but you're not alone with, when you leave the room, this person turns into a different guy, right? When right. the door closes, something else happens. And that's often a similar thing that happens with racism. Like a person, you're like, oh, how could they be racist? I've never heard them say a racist thing. Yeah, but they don't always do that when you're present. When you turn your back, it's different.
It makes me think of, a couple of things there. So one is that there's like overt racism where it's just like your obnoxious racist uncle or something, you mm-hmm. know, for white people at least. And then, there's racism from all, there's prejudices in all different types of culture. I think about like there's the extreme out in the open, like, you know, unabashedly racist, you know, wear it with pride kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, call it heritage, call it whatever. And there's that, but then there's just like the societal, you know, you kind of know what the norms are and you kind of play within the rules of what doesn't get you in trouble. But deep down inside, you know, you might not express these thoughts, but you've got insecurities or you've got, you know, discomfort or, you know, like, I think if you're alone in a room with people of the of a different race and you're uncomfortable with that, it's a good idea to kind of interrogate why, you know,
right.
what makes it that way? And kind of whose fault is that? You know, it's at a human level, it's inside yourself to address that.
Right.
And it also makes me think of another thing, which is if, a lot of times with elections, so you do a campaign, there's polling involved. They do, they'll call people up and say, who are you going to vote for? And the person, it's a known thing that a person, say a white person, mm-hmm. will be more likely to say over the phone that they'll vote for a person of a different race. But when they get in the voting booth and they're in the privacy,
right.
all on their own, then no one's going to know. And
right.
they might have said one thing to the pollster, but in actually voting, then they can vote with their heart.
Yeah.
And it might be that they can't bring themselves to vote for someone of a different race.
It is. Something that I discovered on Twitter and having like a lot of conversations this week is the level at which folks are unaware of systemic racism. Systemic racism is so deep that it doesn't only impact the thoughts of people who aren't a person of color, a person who's black, but it impacts us as well, right? Because we have an entire history. So slavery on this land, it's about 400, started about 400 years ago. So before even the inception of the United States, there's this thing, and it was unique in that there's a part of it was acculturation, basically wiping away the culture. There are certain rules around. It's basically, it's unique in that I have a history in which, so my great grandfather was born a slave, right? And part of that culture is basically, as being a slave, you're basically kept as a pet. And even like the name, if you look at your last name, being a person who is like, whose ancestors were abducted Africans, your last name is derived from the family who owned you. Like, that's a really deep thing. Like, for hundreds of years, which is a really long time, several generations, it was literacy for a black person was a crime punishable by death. That's a really big thing. Because if you grew up like mm-hmm. that, and then you see your grandchildren learning to read, it's a scary thing. So it's right. sometimes what you have, people will say, well, maybe the solution is just adding more people of color into the police force. Maybe that'll fix it. That can certainly help. I for sure want to see more diversity, but that's not the only thing, because oftentimes there can be a culture in which something is inherently, racist, and sometimes a person of color will even be willing to be participating in this racism because it kind of, in a way, it could protect them from, they will get the feeling like, well, I won't have the same experience. It will protect me from this experience and will separate them from it. It's a really deep thing and really needs to be, explored a lot. So for a lot of folks, what I learned on Twitter is they felt that, what happened was there was a history of slavery. Then there was a little bit of Jim Crow, civil rights movement. It was all fixed with laws and we live happily ever after. But the reality is laws don't change thinking. So if you have like centuries of inherent racism and then you change a law, all the people who have these thoughts about the places of in society whites and blacks and people of color, the law doesn't suddenly like click and change that. The other thing I want to highlight is very often people bring up the color of someone's skin. That is for sure a part of it, but the whole black-white thing really isn't about color so much as it is about status, right? Because white isn't really a race. When you think about white, what's the nationality of white? There's not one thing, right? You can be Italian, you can be German, you can be Scandinavian, but there is no such thing as real white. What white is the ability to not to have to suffer the same level of slights. And the thing about that also kind of came up is kind of a Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. And some people are really misunderstanding, like, wait, why is it so bad to say All Lives Matter? All Lives Mattering is like, well, duh. Yeah, of course, All Lives Matter. But the issue is that the All Lives Matter slogan came with a silent but. It came as a response to people saying, hey, we are dying and no one's paying attention. We've been shouting, we've been dying for years and no one's paying attention. Please help us. Black Lives Matter. And the response is, but all lives matter, which is really, kind of devastating. It was never saying that your life doesn't matter. Clearly it does. It's that being a white person, things that happen to black people specifically because they are black never happen to white people specifically because they're white. They'll happen.
That's right.
Even police brutality. Police brutality will happen to a white person, but it's not the thing like where you get pulled over. Or one of the scariest things in my life as a black man is having a taillight go out. Because if my taillight goes out, with most cars, there's no indication to me that my taillight went out. But if I get pulled over, the chances of my life ending are dramatically increased. Dramatically. And, that's not really the same situation that, white people in society have to deal with. They don't have to fear for their lives because their taillight went out. Granted.
The closest thing I can relate to that is if I'm driving, so I live in Mississippi and I've lived in Georgia and Alabama and Florida. And so I've always lived in the South, and that's why I was so curious about Louisiana. The closest thing I can relate to that is so minor. Is that if I have a bumper sticker for a party that is not the party in power in the South, then I feel like I'm more likely to get a speeding ticket if I'm actually speeding than if I don't have that bumper sticker. And that's so minor.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny sense of the feeling, but it's not life or death.
Right. Because, for instance, in the South for a long time, my father grew up in Mississippi in the 1930s where lynching was legal. Like, there was no law against it. It's not a crime if you kill a black person. Just string them up and hang them from a tree. And honestly, that's a lot, that really echoes with a lot of the police brutality that we are currently able to, like, unfortunately, but maybe fortunately, witness now. Because now when people see it, they actually, they're starting to respond a little bit. So with George Floyd in particular, I was really shaken up. I saw the video before it went viral, before everyone saw it. And I didn't know that it was going to be a thing. I didn't even expect it to be a thing because this happens so often and there's no response.
Right.
It happens all the time. There's no response. I didn't really expect there to be a response or even know that anyone would notice. Right. One of the large ones you mentioned earlier, Tamir Rice. That one really, really got to me. Tamir Rice got to me because Tamir Rice was 12 years old. He was playing with, just a child, playing with a toy gun, as children do, and in an open carry state, by the way. So Tamir lived in a state where it's legal to carry around AR-15s with no permit, no license. You just carry it. And that's not what he had. He had a toy gun. And you see a video in which officers drive up, they get out of the car, ask no questions, open fire, and he's dead. And what I expected was the response that we have with George Floyd. I expected people to be outraged, absolutely just like livid that a child was murdered. And what I saw was a lot of just excusing it away.
Right.
One of my biggest fears, in addition to being murdered by the police, because more than once in my life, I have had officers get nervous and draw their weapons on me, which is, I can't really explain what that's like, but what the even a bigger part of that is there's this pattern of having your memory be erased, because what happens is now the PR department for whatever police department gets involved, and now they need to spin the story. Now they need to figure out why this person was no angel, the person who was murdered, why it was their fault.
You know, you'll often see even in media coverage, you know, like you won't see like a graduation photo. You'll see, you know, a photo of a kid being a kid,
right?
You know, a person being a person.
Yeah. And it's crazy to have to both be murdered and then have your memory erased with whatever narrative would depict that he was no angel. And if you remember, even with George Floyd, the initial medical report that came out says, well, he had hypertension and heart disease, so there's no evidence that that it was the officer's knee on his neck for 9 minutes while everyone begged for him to to let up that killed him.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, they try to find a pre-existing condition. It's that he's black.
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah, that's what caused it. And a movie that I really think covers the police brutality bit very well, it's called The Hate U Give.
Yeah, that movie made me cry, and I can't recall crying in any other movie, but I just so connected with just the raw storytelling.
Right, because it tells different perspectives. And even the thing I mentioned before, right? So in the movie, one of the officers is black, and you get to see his perspective about it. That movie gives a lot of different perspectives, including the All Lives Matter, But I Have Black Friends situation, where racism isn't really understood.
Let's talk about the generation thing, because I think part of what that movie shows is that the white girl who has a black friend cannot conceive that she might be prejudiced in some way. And I think it's because she's of a new generation. There's lack of context and exposure. And you can tend to think that today in modern society, this problem has been solved if you don't pay attention. And it's not like, you know, you mentioned slavery going back to 400 years. It's when it goes back and it ends much later. I mean, the 1900s are full of just like very painful, but small pieces of progress. I looked it up. It wasn't until 1967 when the Supreme Court said that a white person and a black person can marry, that you can have interracial marriage. Right. It's like, that was the law in so many states.
Yeah.
And you know, it's wild. And part of growing up in the South, you know, I was exposed to a lot of just, you know, kind of that crazy uncle, except it's everybody in the family, you know, and part of my naivete was I thought at the time that it was just a generational change that would happen, that, you know, God love them. You know, the granddad who is just, you know, Confederate up and down and, you know, lives heritage, would be a generational phase out, and that then there'd be the parents, and then my generation and beyond this could be a thing of the past, but it gets taught and it gets passed down. And my younger brother, I mean, I love him. I saw on Facebook a few days ago, there was a post about protest in Montgomery, Alabama, where he lives. And I know my little brother pretty well. And, you know, but he said, I hope they're careful if they come into Elmore County. I won't lose a lick of sleep mowing down some terrorists. And he's just talking about black protesters. It's like, that's my little brother who like grew up with me.
Yeah.
And he's younger than me. He is that next generation.
Yep.
And it breaks my heart to see that the lack of empathy and the lack of just education, and it's so built into the culture there. And not just there. I mean, this is in Minneapolis. My grandma, who she's 86 and she grew up with racist parents, and she was born in 1935. And so she grew up in Montgomery, you know, as a kid in the 40s and 50s. And something about her heart has just always been that people are people. And, you know, her heroes were like Martin Luther King. And, but even so, she has such pride for Confederate history, that it still slips out. And But her comment about this, just kind of in passing was like, I thought only the South was racist because, you know, this happened in Minneapolis. It's like, no, this is a global thing. I think the same problem is I pick up in the UK, against Muslim people. You know, the best way I can describe it is it's like, you know, using those differences to divide people and build yourself up is like, that's the end goal there. And if you like put yourself in these different camps and not, you know, love each other, then it's like, you're using that as a power play to gain more power. I mean, that's what slavery slavery was. It's like, you know, we have power and we can't let that power go as white people. And it changes the whole economy if you do. And it's insane that in 2020, this still happens. And I think that fact is something that this moment has to shine a light on. That, I mean, I was 21 whenever Trayvon Martin was killed, and that was the first incident of like the, you know, I knew of Rodney King and things of the past, you know, just being taught. But the first thing that I was, you know, being 21, it's like, okay, this is a big deal. Watching this play out in real time, watching how this goes through the court system and how there's no justice, in my opinion.
Right.
And then needing to see President Obama address that as, you know, in such a sober way of like, you know, the court did the thing that they had to do. The jury did the thing they had to do. These are the laws, you know, and this is what allowed it to happen. But should that be the way it is? No. But 2012, that's like, you know, almost a decade ago, and there's been no progress here.
And honestly, that's a painful thing, right? So when you think about the civil rights movement, in which many people apparently, thought that, racism ended, it's been almost 60 years since those marches, right? Mm-hmm. And the way George Floyd died isn't different. Like, there's no, the entire system of how it's processed, it's really not different. And I think a big part of that is not understanding fundamentally what racism is. Understanding unconscious bias. Because again, thinking that laws change it is like thinking that, well, women are no longer mistreated because they were given the right to vote a while ago, right? The law has changed. There can't be sexism now.
Yeah, spousal abuse is illegal, but.
Right. So clearly it went away. As soon as that became a law, right? There's no more domestic violence. It's the same thing. The reason I bring the sexism into it is because there are many people who have experienced sexism and can grasp sexism who wouldn't be able to grasp the racism directly, right? For me, honestly, experiencing racism allowed me to get a better perspective on sexism. And that's why I use it, because sure. They have a whole lot of parallels, right? Including unconscious bias, because you can be completely racist and completely sexist without realizing what being overtly, right? You don't have to be a person who beats women to be sexist. you don't have to be a person who says the N-word to be racist.
Mm-hmm. Man, so it was a lot of this, you know, I'll say this. My first reaction to seeing the George Floyd murder play out is that this is so routine, like mass shootings. You know, if you can go through an elementary school and have elementary kids gunned down and nothing changes, then like, right. What is it that breaks, you know? And so for this incident, for, you know, having a police officer, you know, have his knee on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes and that's what kills him. It's like, okay, like this is a part of America. This is a part of how our society operates. And we've tested this over and over again. And like, I think this is similar to your initial reaction, which is like, you didn't at first believe this would be a thing.
Right.
I in talking just with some colleagues and, you know, people who are younger than me, I was thinking, you know, my reaction, there was sort of from people I was speaking with, a sort of a response that was like, okay, there's the global pandemic, there's this and peaceful protest, and it's very uncomfortable to see the state of the country right now. It's very, you know, it's not a time of peace right now. And I would try to add context to say, this is a part of what we go through as a country. We've been here before. And until something changes, there's no reason to think that we won't be here again and again and again and again. And I hope that what happens here is that it's those generations that have not witnessed this before that take this and, you know, run with it. This is the opportunity to do, to make a difference. And it's kind of disheartening too to think about, you know, President Obama having 8 years in office, and it's also educational that you know, regardless of what you think of the leadership we have right now, it's sort of been tested that the societal change can't come from a president. It can, you know, you can sort of fan the flame and make this way worse. But there's no one person who can fix this, and so educating yourself on ways on efforts that will make a difference. I mean, the thing that stuck out with me the most is the Eight Can't Wait initiative by Campaign Zero, and it's very simple. It's to ban chokeholds and strangleholds.
Right.
You know, and again, this is where law doesn't solve it, but what happened to George Floyd, there was no guarantee that the officer would be charged with anything.
You know? For sure. Absolutely.
You know, you could imagine in a different city even that this would go away. To require de-escalation, to require a warning before shooting, to exhaust all other means before shooting, to have a duty to intervene, to ban shooting at a moving vehicle, to require the use of force continuum, and to require comprehensive reporting. So those are the eight changes that that data shows can decrease police violence by 70%. And the other data point is that it's so simple. Like, unless you study, then you don't know like what is the issue here. And just this stat alone speaks to me. Over 1,000 people are killed by police every year in America, and Black people are 3 times more likely to be killed than white people. So just sitting with that thought, you know, that one line like speaks it all.
Yeah.
Like, this is the problem right now. This is what we're trying to solve. And it can't be one administration for better or worse. I think the hopeful part of this is that even if you have an administration that's not interested in making a positive change here, that I can see historically that having an administration that does want to make a big impact here, unless there is action on the ground in every city to, you know, to teach and educate and accept that, that some basic policy changes are reasonable and not radical, that's what requires change. Right. And so, you know, just in thinking about, 2018 to 2016 and how, you know, these things happened then, and it didn't get solved. It's because there were good ideas that were initiated then that just still haven't been enacted. And it also speaks to, regardless of what situation we're in now, that those same policies, those same good ideas from before, from 4 to 10 years ago, are still relevant now.
Yeah. We need a society that won't tolerate it. And part of what that is education. It's not a part of the normal educational system to really teach about systemic racism. So you kind of have to take it upon yourself that I want a different society. So I want things to be different. So I'm going to educate myself. And then once you educate yourself, you educate your friends, your family, your children, and basically don't tolerate it. If you witness systemic, white supremacy and you just let it go, you give it a pass, then you're allowing it to grow and breathe and continue. It'd be really great because this really, if you think about it, I understand that folks who are participating in it actively feel that it's benefiting them. It's not. Everyone will benefit. Seriously, everyone will truly benefit if this is no longer an issue. It really needs to go away.
Citizens will see police in a better light. I think that's the big impact that sold some change before and over the years is that if you do study this, if society can improve the way that they act toward each other, then and we all act toward each other, then everyone, like you mentioned, everyone benefits. Correct. Because the tension is gone. We're all people. I mean, you know, if it was just a person-on-person problem, then we would address it in the same way. It just happens to be a race problem. Yeah. You know, like if it was about red hair and blonde hair or black hair, then that would be the same thing. It just happens to be the problem of the moment and of the recent centuries has been race instead.
So I really do hope my fear is that once, the protests are done, that.
Yeah.
Everyone forgets like they consistently have over time. And right. To be fair, there are for sure people who are not forgetting. But there's right now there's a movement, right? It's international. There are international marches about this. I have never seen this many people engaged. But part of me worries is that the reason that they're engaged this time, the thing I hadn't considered, is that everyone has been locked up for weeks. And there's really all the attention is here. So the folks who are protesting, many of them would not have taken off work to protest, but they don't have to be at work. So now is the time. So, okay. So now we have the energy. Now that the attention's on it, please do some additional research on your own to just kind of understand the problem. Understand systemic racism, understand what racism is, and then once you identify a problem, then you can start to fix it. But if you're unable to identify it, it makes it impossible to fix if you don't see it.
Yep. One thing that's kind of spoken to me this week is so I do an N5 Mac, and I equally do a website called Space Explored for the network. Mm-hmm. That is space-related. And so there's a company called Virgin Orbit, and I promise this will tie back in, but Virgin Orbit is a company that is developing a way to send rockets to space with small satellites from the wing of a 747 airplane. So instead of launching from a launch pad, they drop a rocket from a plane, and then it goes to space. Their CEO had a message to employees that included a line that I think just really speaks to the technology community as well, which is that this is a quote, too many people lack the comfort and safety to work on tomorrow's challenges. So if you think about what Virgin Orbit does, or even what Apple does, then, you know, it's kind of that discomfort that we've all felt in the past couple of weeks of how can we think about, you know, something trivial when there's this very basic problem of how people treat each other. that can't be solved. And I think that the message from this company's statement is that, you know, we acknowledge that what we're doing is not necessary today. It's a problem that we're looking to solve tomorrow's challenges. But unless we can get along and love each other and change from how society is now, then there's this recognition that what they're doing is just totally trivial.
Right.
And that also, you know, progress necessarily must stop until we can get past this, because you can't have a company like that can't be successful if they can't have the smartest people working on the challenges of tomorrow. And if there's a society that doesn't allow the best people to have that opportunity, then it's not good for the company. You know, I whenever there is a situation sort of politically where, a state, you know, kind of like where I live and live around, that has just some arcane policy that is just backwards, whether it's about race or sexuality or whatever, I like that there's a reaction often that is like, this is bad for business. So it speaks to people who aren't thinking about it on a, empathetical level or just in a human level, but just business and the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And there is something to that, that in all of this, we must stop and educate and improve and grow from this, or this will continue to happen over and over again. And that's just like the, kind of like mechanical utilitarian view of it. But then, you know, of course the real reason is just, you know, imagine having a kid and because of the color of their skin, they might not come home. You know, it's
absolutely. Yeah. For something, insane. For something, trivial, right?
Yes.
For something being like a taillight was out or just routine traffic stop. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. A few more things before we head off. When I lived in Georgia, it was about 50-50 white and Hispanic. And there was one black person in my elementary school, and her name was Raven. And it's kind of wild to be able to name the one black person in your school. But that was my kindergarten to fifth grade experience. Then I moved to Millbrook, Alabama, which is just outside of Montgomery. And then it's I would take a guess at just 50-50 white and black. And I can, and then living in South Mississippi, the same thing, living in South Florida, then it's much, much more diverse than even that, where you've, got a big mix of Europeans and people from all over the world. You know, kind of the first time me being exposed to Jewish people, for example. And so having those different experiences, I think, is informative. I can totally relate, though, to people who only live around people who look like them. And that is not an environment that helps you, that kind of propels education and informs you.
Right.
And so if you're in an environment like that, then please, you know, it's so different than the 90s even. Like, we're in 2020. The internet is a tool that you must use to educate yourself and to, you know, consume media. The hate you give, like you mentioned, it is a very well created movie. And, you know, I recommend everyone watch it. If anyone doesn't have it and they want a copy, I'll buy it. Like, I really feel that way. And, you know, it's like, use the tools we have today to make this moment, you know, sparked by what happened to George Floyd, different than the same thing that's happened over and over again. I mean, you know, and just from my perspective alone, in when I was 21, I didn't have a platform to kind of have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between now and then. And then also kind of just that, like, discomfort with the fact that we're still here and this is still happening, you know, right. All these years later. Use this moment for something and make some improvement. You know, I feel wiser having spoken to you. I feel wiser having taken the moment to just learn something new about whether it's Eight Can Wait, you know, specifically what happened to George Floyd. the history of this happening to Black Americans, what's happening around the world. Use this moment to make yourself more informed and wiser, and we'll all improve from it, I believe.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, listeners, I have a question. How did you sleep last night? What about last week? Has your sleep been better or worse since this time last year? Pillow for iPhone and Apple Watch is here to help you answer those questions and help you understand how sleep affects your everyday life. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing your Apple Watch to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can even compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, and many more health metrics to discover how they might be affecting your sleep. Pillow can optionally record sounds you make during sleep, from sleep talking to sleep apnea and snoring or unexpected noises that might be affecting your sleep. A lot of users have been surprised by the results. For me, when my wife says that I've been snoring lately, this can prove her right. Pillow is also very privacy minded. All your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device in your iCloud storage account using end-to-end encryption. That's the good stuff. Pillow doesn't have user accounts either, so you can use it anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere. No need to worry about that. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being too. And if you're working from home, you can also take naps using Pillow's power nap modes. If you need an alarm, Pillow can wake you up using your iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. And if you have watchOS 6 installed on your Apple Watch, that's the latest update. The new update to Pillow uses something called extended runtime, which all that means for you is it minimizes battery consumption on the Apple Watch. Pillow is available on the App Store for the iPhone, Apple Watch, and even the iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at neybox.com/pillow. That's neybox.com/pillow. Just going there helps support the podcast. Sleep well and stay safe. My thanks to Pillow for their support of 9-to-5 Mac Watch Time. When is the last time you changed your Apple Watch band? It's really easy to do, and it's something I see family and friends do all the time. The only problem is certain bands are only sold for a limited time, and no one wants to overpay. Monowear Design solves those problems. With 10 collections of watch bands available for the Apple Watch, Monowear offers a huge variety of options for both modern and classic looks, using leather, nylon, Velcro, and metal. Each collection offers multiple color tones for both the strap and the adapter so you can match any Apple Watch color. Some of my favorites from Monowear include their NATO-style nylon straps and their all-black perforated leather band. Both are classics that look awesome with any Apple Watch, trust me. Monowear also has metal bands for under $50, so you don't have to spend the price of a new Apple Watch just to buy a metal band. And they have a new urban canvas style that's really comfortable. You can check out Monowear's premium Apple Watch accessories at monowearedesign.com/9to5Mac, including storage options that make for really great gifts. That's monowearedesign.com/9to5Mac. monowearedesign.com/9to5Mac. Thanks again to Monowear Design for sponsoring 9to5Mac Watch Time.